I kind of thought, is he talking about me? He must be talking about somebody else. But anyway, I'm really pleased to be here. It's a great opportunity, and I think it's very well designed, I think, you know, and the way it's set up, and done a good job in doing that. I really am humbled. I'm here with, you know, Steve Dewhurst and David Hartzell and Mike Wilson, and, you know, what are they doing with me? Those guys, I don't know. I don't feel like I fit in with them. They do such a great job. But anyway, it's my privilege to be here, and I appreciate the invitation. My responsibility is to talk about sexual influences in the media, and I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to adults, because we're vulnerable to these things just as much as children are. I told the middle schoolers that I guess it's the same for girls as boys, but I know at some point in a boy's life, the sexual switch is turned on, and he's never the same again. You know, he's never the same. And he looks at things differently. Things affect him differently. He struggles with this sexuality of his for the rest of his life, at least until he's 46. I know that. And I suppose it will continue to go on after that. So, and I'm sure it's the same for women as well. And so anyway, it's a good opportunity to speak to adults who struggle with and battle with this area of their lives. Sometimes I just call it the sex problem. And it is a problem sometimes, dealing with sexuality. You might remember in 1986, the government sponsored a commission to study pornography and its effects. Edwin Meese was the Attorney General at the time, and Ronald Reagan was the president. They really stated the obvious when they said that sexual images in the media are becoming more explicit, more and more explicit, really at an alarming rate. This is the actual quote. It says, more than in 1957, when the law of obscenity became inextricably a part of constitutional law, more than in 1970, when the President's Commission on Obscenity and Pornography issued its report, and indeed more than just a year ago, in 1985, we live in a society unquestionably pervaded by sexual explicitness. In virtually every medium, from books to magazines to newspapers to music to radio to network television to cable television, and now we have to add to the internet, matters relating to sex are discussed, described, and depicted with a frankness and explicitness of detail that has accelerated dramatically in a comparatively short period of time. And that's true. But daytime television, if you're home during the day and you turn on, there's Jerry Springer. Well, you have sexual content discussed just with the degree of explicitness. It's just incredible. I had a teacher one time, he said, you know, part of our problem is that we've lost the sense of place. And there are things that we discuss that need to be discussed, but we have no sense of place discussing them in the right place. And we discuss them in the wrong place. And so, and this is one of those subjects. We just discuss things that are sexual in nature and have no sense of the right place. But this is the right place to talk about some of these things, maybe not all of them, but some of them. I think this is the right place. Now, it used to be that you had to go kind of to the seedy side of town, park your car in the back parking lot of this sort of shabby building, sort of look around to make sure nobody's looking as you go into the adult bookstore in order to find some adult or pornographic material. And you stand there, and here's this sort of pervert over here, and he's looking at, and there's another one over here, and, well, I don't know who that guy is behind the curtain over there and what he's looking at. That used to be the way it was. It's not that way anymore. Now, any savvy, computer-savvy 13-year-old can see explicit pornographic material in his own home, and nobody will ever know it. That's a scary thought, isn't it? You may have 13-year-olds. I guarantee you, if they know a little bit about a computer and a little bit about their way around the internet, and if they've got a computer in their own bedroom, well, they're susceptible to the danger. All right, we're going to talk about that to some degree this morning. I try to emphasize with the young people, and I'll try to do that as well, that that the problem is that we're trying to control, let's see if I can get this up. Yes or no? All right. I'd like to have some of that, but anyway. Okay. But anyway, what I've tried to say is that the problem is that we're trying to control one of the stronger drives of the body. When we talk about controlling the sex drive and sexual desire, we're trying to control one of the stronger drives of the body, one of the stronger desires of the body. Have you ever noticed that sex is all the way through the Bible? From the very beginning, you know, a husband and wife are to become one flesh, a sexual relationship. Adam knew his wife Eve, but they had sex. And she conceived a child with the help of the Lord, by the way. And so that's a good thing. Sex is a good thing. It's right. It's proper. And I tried to tell the middle schoolers that this is not a bad thing. It's a good thing. And then you have stories like Joseph and Potiphar's wife, sexually oriented story, Judah and Tamar, Dinah and Shechem, Samson is a sexually oriented story. David and Bathsheba, obviously, has the sexual component is a large one. The Song of Solomon. Now, I've told the kids, you know, if they hadn't read the book of Song of Solomon lately, you know, to read it, and you come across passages and you think, does that mean what I think it means? Yeah, it sure does. And so, sex is all the way through the Bible, from the beginning all the way into the New Testament. Look at Proverbs chapter 5. I don't usually read all of this passage when I read it in a sermon because, well, it's just kind of explicit and graphic. Proverbs 5, verse 15. Drink water from your own cistern, and fresh water from your own well. Don't go to a harlot or an adulteress. You drink water from your own cistern. You got a wife. Enjoy your wife. And don't go to other cisterns out there. Now, that's C-I-S-T-E-R, not S-I-S-T-E-R. Don't do that either. And then, should your springs be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets, let them be yours alone, not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed, and rejoice in the wife of your youth. As a loving hind and graceful doe, let her breasts satisfy you at all times. Be exhilarated always with her love. Well, that's an explicit passage, isn't it? Let her breasts satisfy you at all times. That's right out of the Bible, though. And so the Bible doesn't try to cover up sex. It doesn't try to hide it. It's very open. This is a big component, a large component of our lives. It's not wrong to think about sex. And I think sometimes we think that it is. And so we try to just eliminate every sexual thought from our minds. It's not wrong to think about sex. Now, it's wrong to think about sex in certain ways. For a man to think about a sexual relationship with his wife, there's nothing wrong with that. And even before we're married, I don't think it's wrong to think about sex per se. Now, it can be distorted and perverted and made into something that God never intended for it to be, and that would be wrong. But what we have to do is control our thoughts and think about these things in a godly sort of way, or in a way that God would approve of them. And then you remember Paul's teaching in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 that the husband is to fulfill his duties toward his wife. The husband must fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. Of course, that's talking about a sexual relationship. But one thing I find interesting about that passage is that it implies that women are have as much interest in sex as men. Sometimes I don't know that we think that way sometimes. We think, oh, it's just the men, you know, the men are driven in this area and women are not. Well, that's not true. The Bible doesn't paint that kind of picture, describe it in that way. Both men and women have a sexual desire. So part of the problem that we face is that we're trying to control this drive that we have. And I think drive is a good word to use for it. It drives us sometimes. Very, very strong desire. We're just made that way. It's just the way we are. But we have to bring it under control and bring it under our own power, lest we misuse sex and use it in a way that God never intended for it to do. But in today's world, with today's media and the constant exposure to sexual images, depictions, and descriptions, it becomes increasingly difficult to control our thoughts. And then, consequently, sometimes our behavior as well. How many men, if I came to you and say, "Well, I've got something, you know, I'd like to offer you. Now, if you take this, your wife will leave you. She'll take your children from you. She'll take your house. You'll lose everything. You'll lose your good name. Now, I've got it for you right here. You can have it if you want, but I want you to know that your reputation will be ruined. And over time, maybe you can repair it to some degree, but you'll never really get it back. You'll lose your family. You'll bring shame upon yourself. The church where you go, they'll disassociate from you." And how many men, knowing that, presented with that sort of scenario, would say, "Oh, that sounds like a good deal to me. I think I'll take it." But you know what? Men have affairs every year, and that's exactly what happens. They know it's going to happen before they do it, if they get caught. And yet they do it. That's how strong this drive is. That men are willing to give up everything for it. And women as well. Women, the same thing happens to women. That's how strong it is. And young people are the same way. What I tell them is, you know, you lose your reputation, you may become seriously ill, you'll lose your freedom to enjoy your youth, your good name will be ruined, you'll bring shame on your family. And yet, thousands of young people say, "Yeah, that sounds like a good deal to me." And they give in, they find themselves, girls find themselves pregnant, not married, and all those things may happen to them, or at least some of them. And young boys, they find themselves fathers. That's how strong the drive is. And so drive is a good word. Statistics show us that men and women, this is men and women, have on average about 8 sexual fantasies a day. All right? Men probably have more than that, I suppose. They think about sex probably more than women. But women think about sex as well. And so that's on average. And so, you know, if you spend 8 hours of sleep and... you know, so that leaves, 16 hours. And so every couple hours, we're thinking about sex. Now, it's not wrong to think about sex. I don't think anyway. But it's wrong to think about it in an inappropriate way. And so we have to control that. And I'm just saying that this is a strong drive. When I came across that, I told the young people, I was a little bit relieved to read that. I thought, that's afraid it's just me. But it's true of all of us, isn't it? And so, you're not alone. You know, if you struggle with this problem, you're not alone. We all struggle with it. We don't like to talk about it. We don't like to sort of open up about it sometimes, but it's true. And anything can kind of turn those thoughts on. And so it might be a touch. So we have to be careful about that. Might be a touch, might just be innocent. But you know, sometimes just a touch. It might be a fragrance. Wow, she smells good today. Wow. All right. So that happens sometimes. And the advertisers know that, don't they? And it might be a picture or a sound or whatever it is. And so we're just susceptible. Again, that's just the way that we're made. And we have to realize that and try to bring these things under control. Again, the Bible doesn't say that it's a sin to think about sex. Looks like the book of Song of Solomon would suggest that to us. But there are other indications of that as well. But we need to think about, it's wrong to think about sex in a certain way. And so Matthew 5, verse 27 says that we are not to look on a woman to lust after her. All right? And so that would be an inappropriate way. And I think to just be specific in our thinking about this particular woman and what things might be like to be with her. And then dwell on that and let our imagination, you know, just create scenarios and so forth. And so that would be an inappropriate way to think about sexual activity. Galatians 5 condemns, among other works of the flesh, sensuality or lewdness or lasciviousness. We're called upon to keep ourselves pure in thought even, in 1 Timothy 5 and verse 22. And do you remember the book of Philippians chapter 4 and verse 8? Whatever is honorable and true and right and pure and lovely. Think on these things. But there's a pure way to think about sex and a good way to think about sex, but then there's a perverted and distorted way to think about it as well. And so what we're trying to do is bring our thoughts about sex under control, okay, and not allow them to go outside those limits. One way we try to satisfy our drive, our interest in sex, is by looking at pictures or reading depictions of sexual activity in a sexually explicit material. And that would include pornography. I'm going to talk a lot about pornography today because I think it's a big problem. It's a big problem in our culture. But there's a lot of stuff that we can use in the way that a man might use pornography. It's not really considered pornography. Sports Illustrated, you know, they do their swimsuit issue every year. Would you say that's pornographic? Well, most people would say, well, no. But we can use it in the same way. So what's the difference, really? If you're using it in that way, what's the difference between that and pornography? All these images sort of arouse our sexual interest and prey upon our sexual desire and sort of influence us to think about things in an inappropriate way. Movies that are considered kind of family fare fall into this category, like Titanic, you know, has that one nude scene in it. And I didn't see that, but understand that it's there. But that's family movie, right? Titanic, that's family movie. And yet, even in these family-oriented types of material, still, the devil is preying upon our sexual interest. We watched Forrest Gump on, it was network TV, so some of it was cut out or edited the other night. We think, Forrest Gump, that's a good movie. And yet there's a sex scene there toward the beginning of the movie. And then whoever the actress is, you know, she's nude in a scene of the movie, you know. I mean, I don't think it's frontal nudity, but the suggestion is there. And this is family stuff. And yet Satan continues to prey upon our sexual interest in areas that we might consider rather innocent. Network TV is almost unwatchable. This show, Hope and Faith, anybody know that show, Hope and Faith? It's got Kelly Ripa in it, you know. Kelly Ripa's Regis's sidekick these days. And I've never seen that show, Hope and Faith, but I saw one scene of it the other night. She works in an office, apparently, and has a friend that works there. And I don't even know what the show was about, but one of the scenes, one of the girls was in the copy room. You know, she had unbuttoned her shirt. She's making a copy of herself on the copier, and she's going to hand that up. Oh, that was just so funny, you know. And Kelly Ripa, of course, she sits on the thing. And she thinks, oh, that's great, you know. That's so funny. But see, and so the devil is inciting us in a fleshly sort of way. That's primetime TV. That's primetime TV. Because that's the family hour. And so, and then there's cable TV. Dr. Phil the other day, he is going to do a show on the Big O. We know what that is, right? The Big O. Well, that's Dr. Phil. That's afternoon TV. And so the devil is, and see, that's out of place, isn't it? We've lost our sense of place. Not wrong to talk about sexual matters in the right context, but daytime TV, that's just inappropriate. And then there's Sex in the City. It's going to come on soon on network television. Then there's cable TV. And then there are novels that are otherwise acceptable, but they have explicit descriptions of sex. Jacqueline Suzanne, you know, she was popular in my day. Judith Kratz, Erica Jong, you know, maybe you guys are familiar with those names, but those are very popular authors. They were all women, but popular authors, but well known for their sexual explicitness. And then there's the magazines, you know. You go to the newsstand and well, I'll tell you what, the fashion magazines are this way. And you have your pornographic section over here with Playboy and so forth. And then you have popular science over here. But in between, you have these sort of semi-pornographic magazines like Maxim or FHM, you know. And I've never even seen what's inside of those. But if you can judge by the cover, now they may not be considered pornographic by most people, but at least semi-pornographic. I see some women going, what's that maybe? You men, you know what, if you go to the newsstand, you know what those are. If not, well, you'll find out. And then any of us guys try to be first out to the mail to pick up the Victoria's Secret catalog and kind of flip through it before Oh, honey, here, you got your catalog today. All right, is pornographic? Well, probably not considered pornographic, but you know, if we use it in the same way, what's the difference? And so all I'm saying is that, well, we're bombarded by these things. Hooters billboards or herbal essence ads, you know, the totally organic experience. That's what that's all about, you know. That's what that is. And so the devil constantly bombards us. And you like John Mayer, you know, he's a popular singer these days. Now, we have a teenage son, and so we kind of listen to some of that music. Your Body is a Wonderland, very popular song. But it preys upon this sexual interest that we have. And that incites us to think about sex in an inappropriate way. But then let's talk about pornography specifically. Now, let's see, where am I? All right, let's go back. All right, let's talk about pornography. Pornography has been defined in this way: a description or depiction of sex involving the dual characteristics of sexual explicitness and the intent to arouse sexuality. Not every portrayal of nudity would be pornographic. If you're studying biology or anatomy or you're in medicine, you might be exposed to nudity, but you wouldn't consider that pornographic because it's not intended to arouse people sexually. Now, you might use it in an inappropriate way, I suppose, but it wouldn't be considered pornography because it's not intended to arouse a person sexually. Those who study these things make a distinction between, say, pornography and, now there's a new term, erotica, and obscenity. In obscenity, the average person, it meets three standards. The average person applying contemporary community standards would find the work taken as a whole appeals to the prurient interest in sex. Sort of the flesh is what the Bible calls that, the flesh. It appeals to the flesh. The work depicts or describes in a patently offensive way sexual conduct. That's obscenity. It's just absolutely offensive to the community. All right. And then, thirdly, the work taken as a whole lacks serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. It's just brute sex. That's obscenity. There's no art about it. There's no really redeeming value to it. It's just brute sex. That would be obscenity. And then there's erotica. Erotica differs from pornography not in explicitness, but in the value or meaning given to sex. Erotica portrays sex in a context of loving, caring, committed relationship. Pornography, on the other hand, connects sex with dehumanizing and degrading conditions. And so a book might be as explicit as another, and yet this describes the relationship between two caring and loving people. And so that's classified as erotica, and this other is just sex for sex's sake, and that's classified as pornography. Well, I would suggest that all descriptions or depictions of sex which are intended for entertainment purposes, but that's just entertainment, are by their nature dehumanizing and degrading. And just let me explain that. When a woman, and most sexes, the object is women, and men are the viewers of it, that's not all pornography. Sometimes it goes the other way. That's a smaller percentage of it. And then there's gay pornography, homosexual pornography, which is a different class altogether. But anyway, any pornography, the subject matter, the woman, it allows herself to become an object used strictly for the sexual gratification of the man who views it. He's not interested in her. He don't want to get to know her, talk to her, or find out her likes or dislikes. He's not interested in that. He's interested in what he sees. And he uses what he sees to satisfy his own flesh. And that's dehumanizing. By its nature, it's degrading, degrades the woman. It dehumanizes her, makes her a thing or an object to be used. And whether it's softcore or hardcore or classified as erotica or pornography, all of it is, what I'm suggesting is, it's just ungodly. It's the wrong way to think about sex. All right, here are some classifications of pornography. I've got a reason for going through these. Nudity, just nudity, that would be pornography in some context. And then there's non-violent and non-degrading material where a woman might be posed in a certain alluring or arousing way. It's not just nudity, it's nudity plus the pose or whatever it is. But it's not degrading or dehumanizing. That's debatable, as we've already seen. But this is sort of a scientific classification. I got this one wrong. It should say non-violent material depicting degradation, domination, subordination, or humiliation. All right? And so, incidentally, this second, let's see, where's my, there it is. This constitutes a very small segment of pornographic material. Very small. Most pornographic material falls into this. It's nonviolent, but the subject matter, the woman, is depicted in a degrading way, or the man is dominating her, subordinating her, or humiliating her, so she might be tied up or something like that, or in some other way depicted in a humiliating sort of way. All right, that's what pornography is all about. It portrays women as masochistic, subservient, socially non-discriminating nymphomaniacs. I'll take any man anywhere, just come on. That's what pornography is all about. All right? And then women who tend to over-respond in serving the male interest. It suggests that women enjoy being dominated, humiliated, bound, and or coerced, and taken to its extreme form, even raped. There's this rape myth in pornography which suggests that although a woman might resist, she really likes that. She likes to be coerced. She likes to be forced. She enjoys it. And so in a pornographic movie, a man may humiliate a woman, and of course she's shown, well, she just loves it. You know, my token resistance at first, but she just loves it. And when a young man is exposed to that, you see, well, see, that affects the judgments that he makes. Women really like this. And so that's what I'm going to do. You know, we don't talk about this very, I don't know if I've ever heard anybody talk about it in this sort of setting. The reason I go over this, this is an ugly business. It's very ugly. It's not innocent. It's not just some girly pictures, you know. It's an ugly, ugly thing. And once we get started, once you get started, it's just a slippery slope. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes. All right, then there's sexually violent material. All right. And then finally, of course, there's child pornography. And that's a big problem just by itself. But that's part of this world that we embark on, that we get involved in when we start. My contention, as I said a minute ago, is that all of it is wrong. You know, part of this would be kind of socially acceptable. The first part, nudity, just plain nudity. Most people say, there's not anything wrong with that. Just looking at a girly picture, nothing wrong with that. But my contention is that it all dehumanizes the object or the woman who's being portrayed. It's all wrong. All right, well, let's move on a little bit. One survey asked a group of high school boys and adult men, how many have looked at or read a Playboy magazine or something like that? All right, what percentage responded that they had? Anybody care to guess? Have you ever looked at or read a Playboy magazine or something like that? High school boys, adult men. Anybody want to guess a percentage? 100%, that's right. You see, the middle schoolers, when I asked them that, one of them said 75%. One said 80. No, 100%. How about women? What's the percentage among women? 97%. And so it's a widespread problem. That's all I'm trying to say. Adult females, 93% have seen this kind of material. How many junior high males, when they were asked this question, junior high males? 97%. You know, I don't ask your boys, have you ever seen this? You know, that's not a fair question, I don't think, because that puts them in a position where I got to tell a lie not to get in trouble. And so unless we're ready for them to ask, well, Mom, have you ever seen that? You know, unless we're ready to answer that question, We can deal with it in a maybe a different way, but I never have liked asking those questions where you put your child in a position where they feel like, man, I got to tell a lie to keep from getting in trouble. If I tell the truth, I'm going to get in trouble. That's going to be worse trouble than if I tell a lie, maybe get out of trouble. So anyway, that's just the way I think about that. The average age of first exposure, for those who could remember, 11 years old for boys and 12 years old for girls. The Government Commission on Pornography said that more than 75% of pornography is seen by children. I don't know what children is, maybe under 21 or maybe under 18 or so, but that's a big problem. It's a big problem even among children. Us guys, we know that. We understand that. If we look back on our own lives, there are 60,000 adult websites. Some sites receive over 50 million hits a month. It's a big problem. That's why I say I want to talk about pornography, because it's a big problem. The commission in 1986 listed 2,323 magazine titles. And so we think Playboy, Penthouse, Hustler, you know, on the far end of things. Playboy is Disney World in the world of pornography. I'm not saying it's right or innocent, it's not. But compared to what else is out there, I've read some of the titles of these magazines. It's disgusting. It's a dirty, disgusting business. It's terrible. And if you get the commission's report, you can get that out of some libraries and read those if you want to. I don't recommend that, but anyway, it's disgusting. 2,000 magazine titles, 2,000 film titles, 700 books from 16 adult bookstores. You know, internet, VHS, DVD has just about put the adult film industry out of business. They don't make adult films anymore. They make VHS tapes, and you get them at the movie store. But you don't have adult theaters all that much anymore. There are some still out there. Why? But how are you going to do that when a guy can sit in his office and watch pornography? Why take the risk of being seen out in public? You know? So those are on the way out. 1 in 4 regular internet users view a sex site at least once a month. 1 in 4. It's a problem. It's a problem among Christians, even. In 1994, before the internet use was widespread, 41% of men admitted to viewing pornography within the last year. That's 1994. That's before the internet. 41% of men admit, yes, I've seen some pornography in the last year. 40% of the clergy admit to having visited a porn site. That's preachers, you know. Clergy is the terminology that they use. 40%. So preachers are not any different than other men. We'd like to think gospel preachers might be a little different, but hey, it's a problem among gospel preachers. I'm sure it is. 37% of pastors admit internet porn is a current struggle for them. That's 1 in 3. So it's a problem. When you can sit in your room by yourself and all you got to do is click, well, I mean, that's going to be a problem. And we need to learn to control it. It's not wrong to think about sex in the right way, but it is wrong to think about it in an inappropriate way. And so, the use of sexually stimulating material, whether considered pornographic or not, is practically universal. There's a book, and David sort of directed me toward this book, Every Man's Battle. It is Every Man's Battle. That's a good title for the book. It's my battle, it's your battle, it's every man's battle to deal with the sex problem. Even if it's just in our mind. I'm not talking about committing adultery necessarily, but I'm just talking about the struggle in our own mind to control our thoughts and being bombarded and all these opportunities that we have. It doesn't make it any easier. It makes it a lot more difficult. But we need to just think about the problem, understand it, understand our problem with it, and try to bring it under control. Why is pornography wrong? Well, let's suggest some things. There's lots of material in the Bible. Don't look at a woman to lust after her. Nakedness is condemned in the Bible. In the prophets, like Nahum chapter 3 is a good passage, I think. When God is speaking to the nations and he wants to tell them, I'm going to humiliate you, I'm going to degrade you, I'm going to embarrass you, among the people, what he'll say sometimes is, I'm going to expose your nakedness. So Nahum chapter 3, this is directed to the city of Nineveh, verse 5, I'm against you, declares the Lord of hosts. I'll lift up your skirts over your face to show to the nations your nakedness and to the kingdoms your disgrace. There's nothing wrong with the body. It's right. God created the body. It's good. It's right. And nakedness within a certain context is a good thing. It's pleasurable. The Bible depicts it as pleasurable. But in the wrong place, just public exposure, it's a shameful thing. In our world, it's a great thing. In the Greek, we've got a book of Greek sculpture. We can't leave it out in case company comes over because it's full of nudity. But in a Hebrew world and among Christians, nudity is a thing to be shared only in the intimate setting of marriage. So anyway, the Bible condemns just public nudity. Those who use pornography use people as objects to satisfy their own lust. That's what it's all about. That in itself is wrong. To use people as things, as objects. It's sensual, it's lascivious. Galatians 5 verse 19 condemns that. It's dissatisfying and frustrating. And so here we have this sort of sexual energy pent up in us. We seek to satisfy that by looking at pornography, and we see that, and maybe it's satisfying for a moment or two, but in the end, it doesn't satisfy. It's dissatisfying. It only inflames us and incites us and arouses those things. And so we're dissatisfied by it. We're not out of time. We're not getting out of time, are we? Okay, let's keep going. Okay. Well, we have lunch, see, so I can just keep going. Because I do have some other things to talk about. So that's the biblical perspective on it. But I want to talk about some other things as well. All right? The Bible condemns the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes. 1 John 2, verse 16. Okay. By its nature, pornography objectifies the subject. We've talked about that, how the woman depicted, it simply becomes an object. And that in itself is wrong. Now these are just some things that researchers have observed. Pornography contributes to a callous attitude toward women. Again, most pornography portrays women as willing victims of men's dominance and loving it. You know, that's the twist in it, that they love it. But anyway, a person's attitudes and then his actions are greatly influenced by the information he takes in while he's formulating moral judgments. And so I'm trying to decide what's right and wrong. And if I'm viewing pornography, and I see here are women, they love being the objects of men and being humiliated and degraded. Well, they love that. Well, if I begin to think that way, and then I generalize that, see, then I view all women that way. And so pornography has a tendency to contribute to a callous attitude toward women. That's not right, is it? That's sinful. And so we formulate our opinions or our judgments. That affects our attitudes, and then that affects our behavior. And then we sort of generalize things. It feeds the male macho ego as it degrades women. But hey, I'm the macho man, and you're my servant. And so we begin to think that way, and that's what pornography does. It fosters a preference. Use fosters a preference for pornography featuring less common forms of sexuality. And so what that means is this, that we're not satisfied with common forms of sexuality. It's got to be more perverted and more twisted to satisfy us. And so, see, levels of excitement decrease with increased consumption of pornography depicting common sexual practices. So here's what happened. Researchers doing their research would take men and expose them to pornography, just sort of maybe Playboy magazine or something that's pretty light compared to other stuff. And so they would look at that, maybe watch a pornographic movie that wasn't really hardcore, more softcore. And then they did that for maybe a few days, and then they brought them in, and then we have to leave the room. And so, and they had all kinds of magazines there, softcore, and then very hardcore, maybe even violent material. Depicted women in this very graphic and very explicit. And you know what the guys did? They'd already seen the soft stuff. And I'm going to look at this. And so they tend toward, once they've seen this, they tend toward more explicit, more hardcore pornography. And so use fosters a preference for pornography featuring less common forms of sexuality. So see, it's a slippery slope that I mentioned earlier. Once you start, you're not satisfied with this. You've got to get something more graphic and more explicit to satisfy our interest. And then we're not satisfied with that. And then we've got to get something harder and more explicit. And then, so it's a slippery slope. Once we get, it's just like a drug, isn't it? It is an addiction in some ways, sometimes. Not everybody that looks at a Playboy magazine is a sex addict. We shouldn't think that, you know. So if we find out, oh no, my son has seen a nude woman, a picture of, he's not necessarily a sex addict. But it can lead to that, and does lead to that sometimes. So we need to be careful. And then, the use or prolonged use fosters presumptions for popularity of less common sexual practices. And so everybody likes this. You know, what we see in the movies, or what people see in the movies, that's what women really like. And so that's what I'm going to try to get my wife to do, or whatever. And that's what pornography does. It creates a dissatisfaction with our lives. All right? Then, it promotes acceptance of premarital and extramarital sexuality. There's no pornography that depicts sex between a husband and his wife. That's not what it's about. It's the chance encounter. You know, it's meeting somebody on the street and the woman is automatically turned on just by the sight of the man. And then, you know, they go somewhere, and that's what it's all about. It's not about husbands and wives. That would take some of the allure away, some of the excitement away. It's all about extramarital or premarital sex. That's what it's all about. And so that sort of creates a dissatisfaction with marriage. There is this idea that people have that pornography is going to help their marriage. And so, you know, I'm a little dissatisfied with my sexual relationship. Let's watch some pornography. And boy, that'll get us going again. It's wrong. It's a lie. It doesn't work. It doesn't work that way. Pornography suggests that long-term relationships only inhibit sexual fulfillment. And so researchers have found that after consuming pornography, participants in the research viewed marriage as less important to personal happiness. It certainly diminished the desire for children. Those sorts of commitments just inhibit one's sexuality. And so we don't want that. We want to be free to play the field, just like the guy in the movie did. Furthermore, this is interesting as well. Prolonged consumption of pornography, when I say prolonged, I don't mean years, I mean maybe weeks. Reduced sexual satisfaction and happiness in a significant way. Here's a quotation. The findings point to a paradox. Presumably, pornography is initially consumed in hopes of increasing sexual satisfaction, but consumers eventually compare appearance and performance of pornographic models with that of their intimate partners. And this comparison rarely favors the intimate partners. Why can't you be like the girl in the movie? Why can't you look like the girl in the movie? Why can't you look like the woman in the picture? Why can't you just go at it all night like the girl in the movie? You know? And so people think, well, we'll watch a pornographic movie, that kind of get us going again. It doesn't work that way. Incidentally, I meant to tell this to the guys, you know, these women in these pictures, they're not real. You know that, don't you? Nobody looks that way. Are they surgically altered or enhanced or airbrushed? Or they're not real people. And so you can see how that would be detrimental to a marriage, not helpful. And then It promotes insensitivity toward victims of sexual violence. And so here's a guy, and he's exposed to pornography. And then the researchers present this scenario. What about this rape victim? And they're more likely to say, yeah, she brought that on herself, probably. And people who are not exposed to pornography, they say, okay, that rapist, he ought to get a life prison sentence. But the viewers of pornography, they're much easier on the rapist. Well, maybe 20 years would be all right. You see, they bought into the rape myth. Women really, really enjoy that, you know. Or at least it's influenced them in some degree. And then, what else was I going to say about that? Oh, yeah. After viewing pornography for some length of time, people were asked, men were asked, do you think you could do this? Do you think you could go out and coerce a woman? And men are much more likely to say, yeah, maybe so, given the right set of circumstances. And so there is this link between pornography and violence. It's no coincidence that all these serial killers and rapists, they go into their homes and they find pornography there. Now, Camille Paglia and some of these, I don't know if you know who Camille Paglia is, but she thinks pornography is great. That's the woman's ultimate expression of power over a man, prostitution and pornography, which, you know, kind of makes it's like a lot of academic theories. Sounds good, but bears no resemblance to the real life. And that's the way that is. And so those ideas are just erroneous altogether. Well, what I want to try to say to people is, this is an ugly, ugly thing. It's not innocent at all. It's not just looking at a girly picture. It's an ugly thing.